is the Norris Group's Real Estate Investor Radio Show, the award-winning show dedicated to thought leaders shaping the real estate industry and local experts revealing their insider tips to succeed in an ever-changing real estate market. Hosted by author, investor, and hard money lender, Bruce Norris.
On Friday, September 27th, the Norris Group proudly presented its 12th annual award-winning black tie event, I Survived Real Estate. An incredible lineup of industry experts join Bruce and Aaron Norris to discuss perplexing industry trends, head-scratching legislation, massive tech disruption, and opportunities emerging for real estate professionals. All proceeds from the event benefit Make-A-Wish and St. Jude Children's Research Hospital. This event is not possible without the generous help of the following platinum partners: the San Diego Creative Real Estate Investors Association, Invest Club, Think Realty, Coach Fullerton, Keller Williams Corona, Property Radar, the Apartment Owners Association, MVT Productions, and Realty 411. Visit isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.
How does somebody that's not big compete with people that have almost no end to the size they can grow? I mean, is that the nature of where, like, most business is going to go, is dealing with a few people? I guess that's my question.
So I think from our perspective, even though we're the largest in the world, we still only represent about 18% of transactions across the U.S., so there's still that remaining 82% that's available to the rest of the world. We actually did just recently sign a deal with Amazon, and it's exactly what you described, right? They're not trying to get into, you know, the home transaction business. It's too sloppy a business, frankly, for them to be able to really scale. What they're trying to do is basically generate a referral platform with their 150 million Prime members and who knows how many, you know, regular members, right? To say, hey, you know, you're on our site, we have all this traffic, if you're interested in buying a house, we have a referral program. The, you know, a realty agent at one of our brands will represent you, right? And then there is a commission split, but it's not a commission split because they're not licensed. But, you know, basically there is X amount of dollars that are spent in buying home products and services from Amazon as a welcome to your house gift to those consumers, right? And you're exactly right. I mean, once they get Alexa plugged in and all that kind of stuff, they own you, right? They know everything about you. So I think it's interesting. So, I mean, you know, from the earlier panel, an interesting thought was, again, we have a hard money lender that helps us buy properties for our iBuyer program. But for the, you know, vast majority of real estate agents that are out there that would like to be able to offer some sort of an iBuyer program, but they have no means to be able to do it other than maybe financing them themselves, that would actually create a great, you know, sort of synergistic relationship between you all and them to be able to say, look, you know, if you have these opportunities, I'm willing to, you know, to buy those properties. How much of them? Usually we're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of only about 5 to 6% are investor grade, right? Or the seller is willing to take sort of the haircut that you all be looking for in order to have your margins, right? That other 95% of leads are meaningful to the real estate agent, right? And so they're thrilled to be able to have a relationship where if the seller does need to sell in some sort of time frame and is willing to take that convenience fee, right, the 7-Eleven factor, that you all step in. Otherwise, it generates much, much more deal flow for them. My final point on that is the Houston Association of Realtors just did a study on this a couple weeks ago, actually. And, you know, 86% of the consumers that they surveyed, the potential sellers, said that given the prominence of iBuyers in the marketplace now, they want to get an iBuyer price to at least know what their backstop is for when and how they might sell their house. So it's in huge demand.
Yeah, I think your point around the iBuyer, as you know, only a small percentage of iBuyers are given an offer, right? So the remaining 90% or 85% are lead gen opportunity for that real estate. And that's gold, right? And so that's why a lot of these folks are able to monetize that business across, because they may not make that much money on that one particular deal, you know, but they're able to capture that lead, and that's what people are doing. And you see more real estate companies and small brokers trying to set up that iBuyer operation in key markets where they want to try to grab those sell-side opportunities. So,
how does the lending industry look at the fringe customer. So I mentioned financing for investors, and you're talking about that getting to be a bigger business, and that's a repetitive customer. So you can have somebody in, like somebody in this audience owns 50 houses with 50 loans. So that's one stop and a loan. And then the other thing I was thinking about reverse mortgages, are those niches that are not big enough to put all the effort in, or is it just solely the owner-occupant?
Well, I think there's obviously still businesses, reverse mortgages, that's still a decent size market. There has been obviously some scrutiny over the years around how that's been executed, kind of disclosure and so on. So that's something that, you know, but with the aging population, I think that's going to be something that's going to be needed more and more. But it's been through some rough waters in the past. In terms of investment, financing for investor, obviously you're all in that business and you know better than I. Most of my members that are independent mortgage banks but in some cases, community banks that have high net worth clients will provide some of that funding. But it's still sort of outside of what their sweet spot is really, so.
Okay. Go ahead. Okay. Is there an underserved market right now in the home, the people that can't get a yes answer right now, that should be able to? What do they look like?
Well, you know, if you look at I'll just sort of look at the demographics. If you look at some of these countries that are dealing with, stagflation, the country is not growing, the housing market's not growing. It's because they're population isn't growing. We are growing as a country,
right.
But that growth is primarily being driven by minority immigrants,
right?
And the lending, the savings pattern, the credit history, the patterns of saving is so different for this new population. There are a lot of people looking at new ways of calculating credit worthiness. Do you have to have a certain number of trade lines with certain number of activities, or can you capture it in a different way? At the end of the day, you want to make sure you want to lend to people safe and soundly and that you're going to get that money back. But I think there are some new technologies and ways that people are looking at lending. Credit scoring models that are different. Frankly, there are a lot of these fintechs that are looking at different ways of lending, capturing credit worthiness. So I think I actually expect a lot of improvements in that regard. There's some crazy stuff that's out there around, you know, looking at your Facebook and deciding your credit worthiness off of Facebook and stuff like that. But, you know, setting that aside, I think we are going to see some innovation coming out of that side of the business.
I just have to smile inside because there was a meeting we had, hundreds of people in the audience, and I hadn't borrowed money in quite some time, and so I was really kind of dumbfounded. I was looking at charts that had gone way askew from what I thought would ever happen. And so we actually interviewed a lender, and it was a very short interview. I said, okay, stated income loans. I said, where does the stated income number come from? And without batting an eye in front of hundreds of people, he says, oh, we just make it up. I was, okay.
Yeah, that was a sort of normal course of business, right?
Yeah, well, it must have been.
Unfortunately.
She asked us to remove that from the...
Or hopefully that person's out of business now.
No. Nope. But she probably doesn't have that loan program available anymore. Okay. I follow charts, try to look at trends, and we have. Now I'm talking about California, but I wouldn't mind, John, just give me some feedback from a national point of view. But with a set of charts that we currently have. We have affordability at 30% in California. Normally, we don't stall until we get to 17. That's a big spread. We have very full employment. We've got inventory at reasonably low levels. We have great equity positions. We have almost no foreclosures in the marketplace. These charts usually are accompanied by price increases in double digits, extraordinary volume of sales. We usually have 4 years of enormous volume of sales. We haven't gone up in 10 or so. So I'm just curious why we haven't had the breakout in sales and price this cycle, or is it yet to come? And I'm missing it.
Well,
I guess I'm missing.
That was called a pregnant pause. The boomers are doing what they said they were going to do. They've said all along, we intend to age in place. So, and I would say that's exacerbated by their knowledge of what happened in the downturn. In addition to which, if they still have mortgage debt left, it's probably at 3.5%. So why would you give that up? So, you know, you've heard me comment on Cape Coral, Florida, which is where I live, and which we're, you're now doing some work in.
Yeah.
The kids call that God's waiting room. and the you can tell they're being raised by an economist. There's no feelings whatsoever, not a part of the transaction. But the story 15, 20 years ago is when the kids move out, the boomers are going to sell their suburban house and buy a condo downtown because they were raised in the 60s and 70s. They're going to party the night away. Well, the evidence from Cape Coral is if you want a good restaurant reservation, wait till about 7:30. Right? But the fact that they're not moving, and they're not. They've said they weren't going to move, and they're not. So if you adjust for population, the existing home supply on the market is at 30-year lows. Okay. So there's nothing to buy.
But right? Why don't you have soaring prices then? You're telling me that you have a shortage of supply. If that was matched with capable demand, we'd be off to the races.
We're not doing PowerPoints, but I have my favorite chart. I'll be happy to share it with you. we track the inflation-adjusted real house price year-over-year change along with current new construction. Those two data points are very tightly correlated for 30 years until the end of the crisis. Now what has happened is that price piece, which price is signaling to builders to build,
right,
or people to supply their homes. It's not just builders, but it's people to supply their homes. There's a huge gap that has emerged between those two. The builders are steadily building, but it's never been the case that first-time home buyers bought a significant share of new construction. That was move-up buyers. The other part of that is the Gen Xers, who were the group that their homeownership rate fell 9 percentage points in the crisis. That's huge. They're the ones that really took the lesson that said, you know, if you held on to the house, you already own the land, which is in an urban area, probably the most expensive part of the house, tear the roof off and put another floor on, or push a wall out and add a room. So they're doing the remodel stuff. They're also not listing that existing home price. So real house price has appreciated very strongly nationally. Okay. The average inflation-adjusted appreciation from World War II to today is about 0.75%. For 5 years, it was over 4% in real terms.
Okay. Sean?
I think one of the issues is that affordability, you know, percentage that went so low in 2006. Like, that's been measured exactly the same way throughout this whole period, but lending has not been exactly the same throughout that whole period. So, you know, when you can get a pay option ARM in 2005 to afford a house, right, affordability can go lower than it can go today.
Sure.
So, I think that there's also maybe 30% affordability, right, by the way they measure it, is maybe not very affordable.
It may be kind of the equivalent of 11 in
it may be the equivalent 2007 of 11 back in 2007.
And 17 and the others. I agree with that. Yeah, I don't disagree with that. That's what the market is reacting like, is that we're sort of done.
Yeah, so we have a lack of supply, but we really are probably pushing up against what people can really afford.
Okay.
I mean, that earlier they were talking about, you know, the number of mortgages with greater than 43% debt to income ratios,
yeah,
and the number with, you know, higher than 90% loan to values. I mean, we're seeing a lot of like 104, 103% loans. And, to me, you know, and then together with that, I heard from a couple of you that, well, there's not a lot of risk in that, right? Because the underwriting's much better and all the rest. Well, if you go back and look at the foreclosures of 2008, some of those folks were fine on an underwriting. It wasn't an employment issue. It wasn't anything else. It was, I overpaid for this house and I want out. And I think from that standpoint, I don't think they will, let me just preface that, if house prices were to fall 40%, all that paper you think so great is absolute crap.
Okay, so let's talk about the next recession then. And the ramifications on our industry price-wise. So is there any consensus? Like, would you say we're going to have a recession in the next 12 months? I'm just going to say yes, no, or maybe?
I'll say no.
No? Okay.
I don't know.
I think we're already starting to see early signs of it. It's definitely obviously not going to be anything like 2007, 2008, but in the next 12 months, sure, I'll say yes.
Okay.
You'll say yes.
Sure.
Yeah, I believe there has to be a small correction. I do.
Okay. Now, okay, Sean.
I think that we don't have a market economy, and I think with our current administration, we would throw anything at not having a recession.
Yeah, we built an index to predict recessions, and normally within the 2 years there's a 27% chance, and according to the data it's a 75 right now, so I'd say that's probably yes, but I agree with him, they'll throw the kitchen sink at it if it's coming.
Okay.
Yeah, well, we don't have the same numbers as John, but the risks are rising. And we're never able to predict exactly when they happen, but the 12 to 18 month time period is
okay.
Is,
well, so here's let's go through the process of okay, we get a recession, and we're gonna prevent it from getting worse. So the first thing Fed does is lower interest rates by typically 4 to 5%, and we.
They don't have that.
We don't have that.
Uh-oh. Sure we do. We can go negative.
Well, there you go. I read that. You can go negative. It's in a report I read. It's not a big deal.
Must be true. It was written in a report, right? Yeah. Well, so if you look at sovereign debt around the globe, take the U.S. debt out of the picture, 50% of sovereign debt is paying negative yields.
Yeah.
That's $17 trillion, right? So
and you pay them to have your money.
Yeah. Now, at the beginning of tonight, I think I mentioned something to the effect, and I just lost my thought. Can you believe that? Well, I'll tell you what was funny. I sent most of the people on the panel an email because we were messing around with the idea of negative interest rates. I said, so, okay, hypothetically, you owe $1 trillion and you'd be able to get a 50-year loan at minus 2%. You would never have to make a payment. It would resolve itself in 50 years just by taking your interest credit. So I thought, that would be good. Okay, so if we have a recession and we don't have that weapon, and by the way, what I was going to say is those countries really are not at the end of their negative cycle, they're at the beginning of their negative cycle. Mm-hmm. Is that correct? Do you think that? Well, like Germany or whatever is going negative, is it going to get more negative?
Well, there's no question their economies have slowed.
Right.
In fact, the Germans were, depending on how you define it, were in recession for a little bit. They're heavily dependent on trade and on manufacturing, and both of those things have been slowing because of the trade debates that are underway. So if you want to see Germany shudder, all you have to do is use the words car tariffs, because that's Germany.
Okay.
So no question, around the globe, things slowing, which is part of the reason that rates are where they are.
Okay, so the Fed can only lower so far, then it starts injecting money?
Yeah, one of the things that Powell did say in an answer to a question was that put the damper on the idea of negative rates. So that is, I think, the evidence that the central banks around the world have seen is that it really hasn't helped growth. But yes, they would ease, they would expand the balance sheet, they would offer whatever liquidity services they could in the industry, but then the rest would have to be done by the fiscal policy. Tax cuts probably would come through.
What they're controlling is the short end,
mm-hmm.
basically.
Mm-hmm.
If you had negative rates that got into pretty negative territory, there's an IMF report I read, it was minus 3%, and they were trying to figure out ramifications of that. So what would happen to our 10-year if something like that was to occur somewhere else? Would we have that invert to quite a low number? I'm just curious.
Well, for those institutions, global institutions who do not have regulatory requirements to hold sovereign debt from their nation, which we do, for example, our banks have to hold treasuries as part of their capitalization, or asset classes for liquidity and safety issues. So some of the institutions obviously hold those securities or those that debt, even though it's going to generate a negative yield over the course of life because of regulatory requirements. But if they are not burdened by that, part of the reason long rates in the U.S. are low is because capital flows to the U.S. because it is a positive return.
Yeah, that's right? My point. If it would be positive, even if it was less negative than where it was coming from.
That's where expanding the balance sheet, increasing the size of that balance sheet will come in to attempt to hold those rates up.
Okay. So we have a recession. Does it cascade into lots of foreclosures this time and therefore have a negative impact on prices?
No. The whole regulatory framework changed in 2009, right? The regulators pre-2009, required that banks get rid of bad assets as fast as possible at any price. And as soon as they changed that, the course of the foreclosure crisis changed. And I'm not good enough on the history of the previous ones, right? But we let the savings and loans fail, right? And they kind of said, oh, we learned a lesson there. We're not going to do that next time. So, I think we learn something each time. We'll make a new mistake next time, but it won't be that.
Well, go ahead.
So I'll agree with Sean, but I'll put a different twist on it. So I think if there's a recession and people stop paying their mortgages, the servicing companies are required to foreclose on them. So I think we're going to see the foreclosure process started. I think the lesson learned this cycle was SNL last cycle was there's going to be a huge amount of money raised to do non-performing loans, and you can sell the pool to non-performing loans. And now you have all these rental companies. They'd be like, give me 1,000 homes with somebody in them that I can restructure as a tenant, I'll take it. And the federal government, actually, we had conversations in 2009 with Doug at Fannie and Freddie and FHA about FHA becoming the landlord in this situation, and they just couldn't do it. I think they're going to find a solution next time. And the other thing is, if they really do hit the market, I've asked American Homes to Rent and Invitation Homes and all these guys this question, like, how soon are you guys going to start gobbling them up? And their answer is as soon as the yields make sense. So
yeah.
I don't think the odds of like a 40% price decline or even a 20% are pretty low in that, in my view. And I actually think those guys would see a lot of new money come in and compete with them.
I think the other thing that is out there is, given the shortage of supply relative to the level of demand, if the recession is mild, say unemployment runs to 7.5%, you still have 92.5% of households working.
Right.
Interest rates come down because the Fed eases. The demand curve backs off because of unemployment. But for those that are still employed, that means price appreciation is slower or maybe zero. And interest rates are great. Pretty good time to buy a house. Especially if there's a foreclosure that you're aware of.
From the lending side, what I've witnessed is, an unbelievable effort to not foreclose on houses in the last bunch of years.
It was sort of drinking out of a fire hydrant, right, for these institutions. They'd never seen that kind of volume coming through of delinquent notes and obviously foreclosures. I remember I actually at one point had an asset management firm that operated out of all 50 states, and one of my clients was Bank of America. They had 1.2 million delinquent notes. And I thought, okay, this contract for me is going to last forever, right? But lo and behold, they started selling off their notes left and right, and literally over about 6 month period, it went from 1.2 to like less than half that, right? And so I do think there's huge appetite to buy, and I'm not sure whether people will be able to buy 30 cents on the dollar or 40 cents on the dollar like they used to last time around. That certainly isn't going to happen. But you also have a situation, I think, right now. The average down payment of what Fannie Mae, what is it? Like, it's probably like 68 LTV. What is the LTV on your typical book of business right now?
Oh, gosh. I'll get a number then. Somebody from Fannie Mae.
You can just make something up and no one will know. Yeah.
Well, 84% of statistics are made up. So.
Yeah. I mean, but the down payment cushion is quite substantial, even for FHA right now. And so I just, you know, it would require a pretty big hit in terms of price depreciation for, I think, big kind of flow of foreclosures and all that to happen. You know, from a lending institution point of view, I mean, obviously, you know, a lot of the community banks that hold the notes, I mean, that they obviously would get hit. People that are selling into the market, a lot of the independent mortgage banks, they, unless they've done something wrong in terms of originating that loan, they probably don't have any repurchase risk related to it. So it just sort of depends on who you are. And my guess is that we will not see what we experience in, you know, 08, 09, 10.
I don't think we'll deal with anything like that quantity, but I was thinking that the consumer kind of has been taught, I'm going to get a hug and get a recast in a 2% mortgage, and they're going to put it on the back end, or they're going to forgive it, and I can stay here for 4 years without a payment. I mean, that's what they just experienced.
Yeah, well, they did experience that, but you also had about 5 million people who actually lost their home.
Yeah, that was the first round, and that's when they went, we better not do that.
Yeah, so I think the pain of those 5 million people are still kind of alive and well. Obviously, there are people who got the pass, you know, they got, you know, they didn't have to pay a mortgage for 3 years or whatever it was, you know, and you certainly had those situations, but I do think just the general perception in the market is people got hit pretty hard. You know, a lot of people literally lost their home and really lost their kind of their trajectory in their life, right? So, and people are just kind of recovering from all of that now, and I don't know if it will be viewed as this kind of positive experience that somehow they'll get saved through the process, so.
The Norris Group originates and services loans in California and Florida under California DRE License 01219911, Florida Mortgage Lender License 1577, and NMLS License 1623669. For more information on hard money lending, go to thenorrisgroup.com and click the Hard Money tab.
The Norris Group would like to thank its gold sponsors for supporting I Survived Real Estate, Coldwell Banker Town & Country, In a Day Development, Inland Valley Association of Realtors, Keystone CPA, Las Brisas Escrow, LA South RIA, Michael Ryan and Associates, NorCal RIA, NSDREI, Orange County Real Estate Investors, Pacific Premier Bank, Pasadena Phoebe, Shenbaum Group, SJREI, Spinnaker Loans, South OC RIA, UDirect IRA Services, White House Catering, Wilson Investment Properties. See isurvivedrealestate.com for event information.
For more information on hard money loans and upcoming events with the Norris Group, check out thenorrisgroup.com. For information on passive investing with trust deeds, visit tngtrustdeeds.com.